Part 4. Chapter 1. The Karenins, husband and wife, continued living in the same house, met every day, but were complete strangers to one another. Alexei Alexandrovitch made it a rule to see his wife every day, so that the servants might have no grounds for suppositions, but avoided dining at home. Vronsky was never at Alexei Alexandrovitch's house, but Anna saw him away from home, and her husband was aware of it. The position was one of misery for all three. And not one of them would have been equal to enduring this position for a single day if it had not been for the expectation that it would change, that it was merely a temporary painful ordeal which would pass over. Alexei Alexandrovitch hoped that this passion would pass as everything does pass, that everyone would forget about it, and his name would remain unsullied. Anna, who was responsible for the situation, and for whom it was more miserable than for anyone, endured it because she not merely hoped, but firmly believed, that it would all very soon be settled and alleviated. She had not the least idea what would settle the situation, but she firmly believed that something would turn up very soon. Vronsky, against his own will or wishes, followed her lead, hoped too that something, apart from his own action, would be sure to solve all difficulties. In the middle of the winter, Vronsky spent a very tiresome week. A foreign prince who had come on a visit to Petersburg was put under his charge, and he had to show him the sights worth seeing. Vronsky was of distinguished appearance. He possessed, moreover, the art of behaving with respectful dignity, and was used to dealing with such important dignitaries. That was why he came to be put in the charge of the prince. But he felt his duties very irksome. The prince was anxious to miss nothing of which he would be asked at home, had he seen that in Russia, and on his own account he was anxious to enjoy to the utmost all Russian forms of amusement. Vronsky was obliged to be his guide in satisfying both these inclinations. The mornings they spent driving to look at places of interest. The evenings they passed enjoying the national entertainments. The prince rejoiced in health exceptional even among princes. By gymnastics and careful attention to his health, he had brought himself to such a point that in spite of his excesses in pleasure, he looked as fresh as a big, glossy, green Dutch cucumber. The prince had travelled a great deal, and considered that one of the chief advantages of modern facilities of communication was the accessibility of the pleasures of all nations. He had been in Spain, and there had indulged in serenades, and had made friends with a Spanish girl who played the mandolin. In Switzerland, he had killed a chamois. In England, he had galloped in a red coat over hedges, and killed 200 pheasants for a bet. In Turkey, he had got into a harem. In India, he had hunted on an elephant. And now, in Russia, he wished to taste all the typically Russian forms of pleasure. Vronsky, who was, as it were, chief master of ceremonies, was at great pains to arrange all the Russian amusements suggested by various persons to the prince. Races, and Russian pancakes, and bear hunts, and troikas, and gypsies, and drinking feasts with the Russian accompaniment of broken crockery. And the prince, with surprising ease, fell in with the Russian spirit, smashed trays full of crockery, sat with a gypsy girl on his knee, and seemed to be asking, "What more? And does the whole Russian spirit consist in just this?" In reality, of all the Russian entertainments, the prince liked best French actresses and ballet dancers and white seal champagne. Vronsky was used to princes, but either because he had himself changed of late, or because he was in too close proximity to the prince, that week seemed fearfully wearisome to him. The whole of that week he experienced a sensation such as a man might have who had been placed in charge of a dangerous madman, afraid of the madman, and at the same time, from being with him, afraid for his own reason. Vronsky was continually conscious of the necessity of never for a second relaxing the tone of stern official respectfulness, so that he might not himself be insulted. The prince's manner of treating the very people who, to Vronsky's surprise, were ready to descend to any depths to provide him with Russian amusements, was contemptuous. His criticism of Russian women, whom he wished to study, more than once made Vronsky crimson with indignation. The chief reason why the prince was so particularly disagreeable to Vronsky was that he couldn't help seeing himself in him. And what he saw in this mirror did not gratify his self-esteem. He was a very stupid and very self-satisfied and very healthy and very immaculate man, and nothing else. He was a gentleman, that was true, and Vronsky couldn't deny it. He was equable, and didn't cringe before his superiors, was free and ingratiating in his behaviour with his equals, and was contemptuously indulgent with his inferiors. Vronsky was himself the same, and regarded it as a great merit to be so. But for this prince he was an inferior, and his contemptuous and indulgent attitude toward himself revolted Vronsky.
"Brainless beef! Can I be like that?" he thought.
Be that as it might, when on the seventh day he parted from the prince, who was starting for Moscow, and received his thanks, he was happy to be rid of this uncomfortable situation and the unpleasant reflection of himself. He said goodbye to him at the station on their return from a bear hunt, at which they had had a display of Russian prowess kept up all night. Chapter 2. When he got home, Vronsky found a note from Anna. She wrote, "I'm ill and unhappy. I cannot come out, but cannot go on longer without seeing you. Come this evening. Alexei Alexandrovich goes to the council at 7, and will be there till 10. Thinking for an instant of the strangeness of her bidding him to come straight to her, in spite of her husband's insisting on her not receiving him, he decided to go. Vronsky had that winter got his promotion, was now a colonel, had left the regimental quarters, and was living alone. After having some lunch, he lay down on the sofa immediately, and in 5 minutes memories of the hideous scenes he had witnessed during the last few days were mixed together and joined to a mental image of Anna, and of the peasant who had played an important part in the bear hunt, and Vronsky fell asleep. He woke in the dark, trembling with horror, and made haste to light a candle. What was it? What? What was the dreadful thing I dreamed? Yes, yes. I think a short, filthy man with a dishevelled beard was stooping down doing something, and all of a sudden he began saying some strange words in French. Yes. There was nothing else in the dream, he said to himself. But why was it so awful? He vividly recalled the peasant again, and those incomprehensible French words the peasant had uttered, and a chill of horror ran down his spine. What nonsense, thought Vronsky, and glanced at his watch. It was 8:30 already. He rang for his servant, dressed in haste, and went out onto the steps, completely forgetting the dream, and only worried about being late. As he drove up to the Karenins' entrance, he looked at his watch and saw that it was 9:10. A high, narrow carriage with a pair of greys was standing at the entrance. He recognized Anna's carriage. She's coming to me, thought Vronsky, and it's better. I don't like going into that house. But no matter. I can't hide myself, he thought. And with that manner peculiar to him from childhood, as of a man who has nothing to be ashamed of, Vronsky got out of his sleigh and went to the door. The door opened, and the hall porter, with a comforter on his arm, called the carriage. Vronsky, though he didn't usually notice details, noticed at this moment the amazed expression with which the porter glanced at him. In the doorway, Vronsky almost ran up against Alexei Alexandrovich. The gas jet threw its full light on the bloodless, sunken face under the black hat, and on the white cravat, brilliant against the beaver of the coat. Karenin's fixed, dull eyes were fastened upon Vronsky's face. Vronsky bowed, and Alexei Alexandrovich, compressing his lips as if chewing, lifted his hand to his hat and went out. Vronsky saw him get into the carriage without looking around, pick up the comforter and the opera glasses, and disappear. Vronsky went into the hall. His brows were scowling, and his eyes gleamed with a proud and angry light in them. What a situation, he thought. If he would fight, would stand up for his honour, I could act, could express my feelings, but this weakness or baseness. He puts me in the position of a deceiver, which I never was and never meant to be. Vronsky's ideas had changed since the day of his conversation with Anna in the reed garden. Unconsciously yielding to the weakness of Anna, who had surrendered herself up to him utterly, and simply looked to him to decide her fate, ready to submit to anything, he had long ceased to think that their union might end as he had thought then. His ambitious plans had retreated into the background again, and feeling that he had got out of that circle of activity into which everything was definite, he had given himself entirely to his passion, and that passion was binding him more and more closely to her. He was still in the hall when he caught the sound of her retreating footsteps. He knew that she had been expecting him, had listened for him, and was now going back to the drawing-room. "No," she cried on seeing him, and at the first sound of her voice the tears came into her eyes. "No, if things are to go on like this, the end will come much, much too soon."
"What is it, dear one?"
"What? I've been waiting in agony for an hour, 2 hours. No, I won't. I can't quarrel with you. Of course you couldn't come." "No, I won't." She laid her hands on his shoulders and looked a long while at him with a profound, passionate, and at the same time searching look. She was studying his face to make up for the time she hadn't seen him. She was, every time she saw him, comparing the picture she had painted of him in her imagination, incomparably superior, impossible in reality, with him as he really was. Chapter 3 "You met him?" she asked, when they had sat down at the table in the lamplight. "You're punished, you see, for being late?"
"Yes, but how did it happen? Wasn't he to be at the council?"
"He'd been and came back and was going out somewhere again. But that's no matter. Don't talk about it. Where have you been? With the prince still?" She knew every detail of his existence.
He was going to say that he had been up all night and had dropped asleep, but looking at her thrilled and rapturous face, he was ashamed.
"And he said he had had to go to report on the prince's departure."
"But it's over now. He is gone."
"Thank God it's over. You wouldn't believe how insufferable it's been for me."
"Why so? Isn't it the life all of you, all young men, always lead?" she said, knitting her brows, and taking up the crocheting that was lying on the table, she began drawing the hook out of it without looking at Vronsky.
"I gave up that life long ago," said he, wondering at the change in her face and trying to divine its meaning. "And I confess," he said, with a smile showing his tightly packed white teeth, "watching that life, I didn't like it."
She held the work in her hands, but didn't crochet, and looked at him with strange, shining and hostile eyes. "This morning Liza came to see me. They're not afraid to call on me in spite of Countess Lydia Ivanovna," she put in. "And she told me about your orgy. How loathsome."
"I was just going to say..."
She interrupted him. "Was it that Teresa you used to know?"
"I was just saying..."
"How disgusting you are, you men. How is it you can't understand that a woman can never forget that?" she said, getting more and more angry, and so letting him see the cause of her irritation. "Especially a woman who cannot know your life." "What do I know? What have I ever known?" she said. "What you tell me. And how do I know whether you tell me the truth?"
"Anna, you hurt me. Don't you trust me? Haven't I told you that I haven't a thought I wouldn't lay bare to you?"
"Yes. Yes," she said, evidently trying to suppress her jealous thoughts. "But if only you know how wretched I am." "I believe you. I believe you. What were you saying?" But he couldn't at once recall what he had been going to say. These fits of jealousy, which of late had been more and more frequent with her, horrified him, and however much he tried to disguise the fact, made him feel cold to her, although he knew the cause of her jealousy was her love for him. How often he had told himself that her love was happiness, and now she loved him as a woman can love when love has outweighed for her all the good things of life. And he was much further from happiness than when he had followed her from Moscow. Then he had thought himself unhappy, but happiness was before him. Now he felt that the best happiness was already left behind. She was utterly unlike what she had been when he first saw her. Both morally and physically, she had changed for the worse. She had broadened out all over, and in her face, at the time when she was speaking of the actress, there was a malevolent expression of hatred that distorted it. He looked at her as a man looks at a faded flower he has gathered, with difficulty recognizing in it the beauty for which he had picked and ruined it. And in spite of this, he felt that then, when his love was stronger, he could, if he had greatly wished it,
have torn that love out of his heart. But now, when as at that moment it seemed to him he felt no love for her, he knew that what bound him to her could not be broken.
"Well, well, what was it you were going to say about the prince? I've driven away the fiend," she added. The fiend was the name they had given her jealousy. "What did you begin to tell me about the prince? Why did you find it so tiresome?"
"Oh, it was intolerable," he said, trying to pick up the thread of his interrupted thought. "He doesn't improve on close acquaintance. If you want him defined, here he is. A prime, well-fed beast, the kind that wins medals at the cattle shows, and nothing more," he said, with a tone of vexation that interested her.
"No? How so?" she replied.
"He's seen a great deal anyway.
He's cultured?"
"It's an utterly different culture, their culture. He's cultivated, one sees, simply to be able to despise culture, as they despise everything but animal pleasures."
"But don't you all care for these animal pleasures?" she said. And again he noticed a dark look in her eyes that avoided him.
"How is it that you're defending him?" he said, smiling.
"I'm not defending him. It's nothing to me. But I imagine if you had not cared for those pleasures yourself, you might have got out of them.
But if it affords you satisfaction to gaze at Teresa in the costume of Eve..." "Again, the devil again," Vronsky said, taking the hand she laid on the table and kissing it.
"Yes, but I can't help it. You don't know what I've suffered waiting for you. I believe I'm not jealous. I'm not jealous. I believe you when you're here. But when you're away somewhere, leading your life so incomprehensible to me..."
She turned away from him, pulled the hook at last out of the crochet work, and rapidly, with the help of her forefinger, began working loop after loop of the wool that was dazzling white in the lamplight, while the slender wrist moved swiftly, nervously, in the embroidered cuff.
"How was it, then? Where did you meet Alexei Alexandrovich?"
The tone of her voice was unnatural and jarring.
"We ran up against each other in the doorway."
"And he bowed to you like this?"
She drew a long face, and half closing her eyes, quickly transformed her expression, folded her hands, and Vronsky suddenly saw in her beautiful face the very expression with which Alexei Alexandrovich had bowed to him. He smiled while she laughed gaily, with that sweet, deep laugh which was one of her greatest charms.
"I don't understand him in the least," said Vronsky. "If after your talk to him at your country house he had broken with you, if he had challenged me... But this I can't understand. How can he put up with such a situation? He feels it, that's evident."
"He?" she said sneeringly. "He's perfectly satisfied."
"Why are we all miserable when everything might be so happy?"
"Not him. Don't I know him, the falsity in which he's utterly steeped? Could one, with any feeling, live as he is living with me? He understands nothing and feels nothing. Could a man of any feeling live in the same house with his unfaithful wife? Could he talk to her, call her my dear?"
And again she couldn't help mimicking him.
"Anna, ma chère, Anna, dear." "He's not a man, not a human being, he's a puppet. No one knows him, but I know him. Oh, if I'd been in his place, I'd long ago have killed, have torn to pieces a wife like me. I wouldn't have said, 'Anna, ma chère.' He's not a man. He's an official machine. He doesn't understand that I'm your wife, that he's outside, that he's superfluous. Don't let's talk of him."
"You're unfair, very unfair, dearest," said Vronsky, trying to soothe her.
"But never mind. Don't let's talk of him. Tell me what you've been doing.
What's the matter? What's been wrong with you?
And what did the doctor say?"
She looked at him with mocking amusement. Evidently, she had hit on other absurd and grotesque aspects in her husband, and was awaiting the moment to give expression to them. But he went on.
"I imagine that it's not illness, but your condition.
When will it be?" The ironical light died away in her eyes, but a different smile, a consciousness of something
he didn't know what, and of quiet melancholy came over her face.
Soon.
Soon.
You say that our situation is miserable, that we must put an end to it. If you knew how terrible it is to me, what I would give to be able to love you freely and boldly. I shouldn't torture myself and torture you with my jealousy. And it will come soon, but not as we expect. And at the thought of how it would come, she was so sorry for herself that tears came into her eyes and she couldn't go on. She laid her hand on his sleeve, dazzling and white with its rings in the lamplight. "It won't come as we suppose. I didn't mean to say this to you, but you've made me. Soon, soon, all will be over, and we shall all be at peace, and suffer no more."
"I don't understand," he said, understanding her.
"You asked when?"
"Soon."
"And I will not live through it. Don't interrupt me." And she made haste to speak. "I know it. I know for certain. I shall die, and I'm very glad I shall die, and release myself and you."
Tears dropped from her eyes. He bent down over her hand and began kissing it, trying to hide his emotions, which he knew had no foundation, though he couldn't control it.
"Yes, it's better so," she said, tightly gripping his hand.
"That's the only way left us." He had recovered himself and lifted his head.
"How absurd! What absurd nonsense you're talking!"
"No, it's the truth."
"What? What's the truth?"
"That I shall die. I've had a dream."
"A dream?" repeated Vronsky, and instantly he recalled the peasant of his dream.
"Yes, a dream," she said. "It's a long while since I dreamed it. I dreamed that I ran into my bedroom, that I had to get something there, to find out something.
You know how it is in dreams," she said, her eyes wide with horror.
"And in the bedroom, in the corner, stood something."
"Oh, what nonsense! How can you believe—"
But she wouldn't let him interrupt her. What she was saying was too important to her. "And the something turned round, and I saw it was a peasant with a dishevelled beard, small and dreadful-looking. I wanted to run away, but he bent down over a sack and was fumbling there with his hands." She showed how he had moved his hands. There was terror in her face, and Vronsky, remembering his dream, felt the same terror filling his soul.
"He was fumbling and kept talking quickly, quickly in French, you know. Il faut le battre, le faire, le broyer, le pétrir. You know, the iron must be beaten, pound it, mould it.
And in my horror I tried to wake up, and woke up, but woke up in another dream. And I began asking myself what it meant, and Corny said to me, 'In childbirth you'll die, ma'am, you'll die.' And I woke up."
"What nonsense, what nonsense!" said Vronsky.
But he felt himself that there was no conviction in his voice.
"But let's not talk about it. Ring the bell. I'll have tea, and stay a little now. It won't be long. I shall—"
But all at once she stopped. The expression of her face instantaneously changed. Horror and agitation were suddenly replaced by a look of soft, solemn, blissful attention. He couldn't comprehend the meaning of the change. She was listening to the stirring of a new life within her. Chapter 4.
Alexei Alexandrovich, after meeting Vronsky on his own steps, drove as he had intended to the Italian Opera. He sat through two acts there and saw everyone he had wanted to see. On returning home, he carefully scrutinized the coat stand, and noticing that there was not a military overcoat there, he went as usual to his own room. But contrary to his usual habit, he didn't go to bed. He walked up and down his study till 3 o'clock in the morning. The feeling of furious anger with his wife, who would not observe the proprieties and keep to the one stipulation he had laid on her, not to receive her lover in her own house, gave him no peace. She had not complied with his request, and he was bound to punish her and carry out his threat, obtain a divorce, and take away his son. He knew all the difficulties connected with this course, but he had said he would do it, and now he must carry out his threat.
Countess Lydia Ivanovna had hinted that this was the best way out of his situation, and of late the obtaining of divorces had been brought to such perfection that Alexey Alexandrovitch saw a possibility of overcoming the formal difficulties. Misfortunes never come singly, and the affairs of the reorganization of the native population and of the irrigation of the lands of the Zaraisky province had brought such official worries upon Alexey Alexandrovitch that he had been of late in a continual condition of extreme irritability. He didn't sleep the whole night, and his fury, growing in a sort of giant progression, reached its highest limits in the morning. He dressed in haste, and as though carrying his cup full of wrath, and fearing to spill any over, fearing to lose with his wrath the energy necessary for the interview with his wife, he went into her room as soon as he heard she was up. Anna, who had thought she knew her husband so well, was amazed at his appearance when he went into her. His brow was furrowed, and his eyes stared darkly before him, avoiding her eyes. His mouth was tightly and contemptuously shut. In his walk, in his gestures, in the sound of his voice, there was a determination and firmness such as his wife had never seen in him. He went into her room, and without greeting her, walked straight up to her writing-table, and taking her keys, opened a drawer. "What do you want?" she cried.
"Your lover's letters," he said.
"They're not here," she said, shutting the drawer. But from that action he saw that he had guessed correctly, and roughly pushing away her hand, he quickly snatched a portfolio in which he knew she used to put her most important papers. She tried to pull the portfolio away, but he pushed her back.
"Sit down. I have to speak to you," he said,
putting the portfolio under his arm, and squeezing it so tightly with his elbow that his shoulder lifted up. Amazed and intimidated, she gazed at him in silence.
"I told you I would not allow you to receive your lover in this house.
I had to see him to—" She stopped, not finding a reason.
"I do not enter into the details of why a woman wants to see her lover."
"I meant I only—" she said, flushing hotly. This coarseness of his angered her and gave her courage.
"Surely you must feel how easy it is for you to insult me," she said. "An honest man and an honest woman may be insulted, but to tell a thief he is a thief is simply la constatation d'un fait, the statement of a fact."
"This cruelty is something I didn't know in you before."
"You call it cruelty for a husband to give his wife freedom, giving her the honourable protection of his name, simply on the condition of observing the proprieties. Is that cruelty?"
"It's worse than cruel. It's base, if you want to know,"
Anna cried in a rush of hatred, and getting up she began to leave.
"No," he shrieked in his shrill voice, which rose a note higher than usual, and his big hands clutching her by the arm so violently that red marks were left from the bracelet he was squeezing, he forcibly sat her down in her place.
"Base! If you care to use that word, what is base is to forsake husband and child for a lover while you eat your husband's bread."
She bowed her head. She didn't say what she had said the evening before to her lover, that he was her husband, and that her husband was superfluous. She didn't even think that. She felt the full justice of his words, and only said softly, "You cannot describe my position as worse than I feel it to be myself. But what are you saying all this for?"
"What am I saying it for? What for?" he went on as angrily. "That you may know that since you have not carried out my wishes in regard to observing outward decorum, I will take measures to put an end to this state of affairs."
"Soon, very soon, it will end anyway," she said. And again, at the thought of death near at hand and now desired, tears came into her eyes.
"It will end sooner than you and your lover have planned, if you must have the satisfaction of animal passion."
"Alexey Alexandrovitch, I won't say it's not generous, but it's not like a gentleman to strike one who's down."
"Yes, you only think of yourself. But the sufferings of a man who was your husband have no interest for you. You don't care that his whole life is ruined, that he's thuff.
Alexey Alexandrovitch was speaking so quickly that he stammered, and was utterly unable to articulate the word suffering. In the end, he pronounced it fuffering. She wanted to laugh, and was immediately ashamed that anything could amuse her at such a moment. And for the first time, for an instant, she felt for him, put herself in his place, and was sorry for him. But what could she say or do? Her head sank, and she sat silent. He, too, was silent for some time, and then began speaking in a frigid, less shrill voice, emphasizing random words that had no special significance. "I came to tell you," he said. She glanced at him. No, it was my imagination, she thought, recalling the expression of his face when he stumbled over the word suffering. No. Can a man with those dull eyes, with that self-satisfied complacency, feel anything? I cannot change anything, she whispered. I've come to tell you that I'm going to Moscow tomorrow, and shall not return again to this house, and you will receive notice of what I decide through the lawyer into whose hands I shall entrust the task of getting a divorce. My son is going to my sister's, said Alexei Alexandrovitch, with an effort recalling what he had meant to say about his son. You take Seryozha to hurt me, she said, looking at him from under brows. You don't love him. Leave me, Seryozha. Yes, I've lost even my affection for my son because he is associated with the revulsion I feel for you. But still I shall take him. Goodbye. And he was going away, but now she detained him. Alexei Alexandrovitch, leave me, Seryozha, she whispered once more. I have nothing else to say. Leave Seryozha till my... I shall soon be confined. Leave him. Alexei Alexandrovitch flew into a rage, and snatching his hand from her, he went out of the room without a word. Chapter 5 The waiting room of the celebrated Petersburg lawyer was full when Alexei Alexandrovitch entered it. Three ladies, an old lady, a young lady, and a merchant's wife, and three gentlemen, one a German banker with a ring on his finger, the second a merchant with a beard, and the third, a wrathful-looking government clerk in official uniform with an order on his neck, had obviously been waiting a long while already. Two clerks were writing at tables with scratching pens. The materials of the writing tables, about which Alexei Alexandrovitch was himself very fastidious, were exceptionally good. He couldn't help observing this. One of the clerks, without getting up, turned roughly to Alexei Alexandrovitch, half-closing his eyes.
"What do you want?"
He replied that he had to see the lawyer on some business.
"He is engaged,"
the clerk responded severely, and he pointed with his pen at the persons waiting, and went on writing.
"Can't he spare time to see me?" said Alexei Alexandrovitch. "He has no time free. He's always busy. Kindly wait your turn." "Then I must trouble you to give him my card," Alexei Alexandrovitch said with dignity, seeing the impossibility of preserving his incognito. The clerk took the card, and obviously not approving of what he read on it, went to the door. Alexei Alexandrovitch was, on principle, in favour of public trials, though for some higher official considerations he disliked the application of the principle in Russia, and disapproved of it, as far as he could disapprove of anything instituted by the authority of the Emperor. His whole life had been spent in administrative work, and consequently, when he didn't approve of anything, his disapproval was softened by the recognition of the inevitability of mistakes, and the possibility of reform in every department. In the new public law courts, he disliked the restriction laid on the lawyers conducting cases. But till then, he had had nothing to do with the courts, and so had disapproved of them simply in theory. Now, his disapprobation was strengthened by the unpleasant impression made on him in the lawyer's waiting room. "Coming immediately," said the clerk.
And 2 minutes later there did actually appear in the doorway the large figure of an old solicitor who had been consulting with the lawyer himself. The lawyer was a little squat bald man with a dark, reddish beard, light-coloured long eyebrows,
and an overhanging brow. He was attired as though for a wedding, from his cravat to his double watch chain and patent leather shoes. His face was intelligent and peasant-like, but his clothes were dandified and in bad taste.
"Pray walk in," said the lawyer, addressing Alexei Alexandrovitch, and gloomily ushering Karenin in before him, he closed the door. "Won't you sit down?"
He indicated an armchair at a writing-table covered with pages. He sat down himself, and rubbing his little hands with short fingers covered with white hairs, he bent his head to one side. But as soon as he was settled in this position, a moth flew over the table. The lawyer, with a swiftness that could never have been expected of him, opened his hands, caught the moth, and resumed his former attitude.
"Before beginning to speak of my business," said Alexei Alexandrovitch, following the lawyer's movements with astonishment, "I ought to observe that the business about which I have to speak to you is to be strictly private."
The lawyer's drooping red moustaches were parted in a scarcely perceptible smile.
"I shouldn't be a lawyer if I couldn't keep the secrets confided to me, but if you would like proof—"
Alexei Alexandrovitch glanced at his face, and saw that the shrewd grey eyes were laughing and seemed to know all about it already.
"You know my name?" Alexei Alexandrovitch resumed. "I know you and the good—"
Again he caught a moth.
"Work you are doing, like every Russian," said the lawyer, bowing.
Alexei Alexandrovitch sighed, plucking up his courage. But having once made up his mind, he went on in his shrill voice, without timidity or hesitation, accentuating here and there a word.
"I have the misfortune," Alexei Alexandrovitch began, "to have been deceived in my married life, and I desire to break off all relations with my wife by legal means, that is, to be divorced, but to do this so that my son may not remain with his mother."
The lawyer's grey eyes tried not to laugh, but they were dancing with irrepressible glee. And Alexei Alexandrovitch saw that it was not simply the delight of a man who has just got a profitable job. There was triumph and joy. There was a gleam like the malignant gleam he saw in his wife's eyes.
"You desire my assistance in securing a divorce?"
"Yes, precisely so. But I ought to warn you that I may be wasting your time and attention. I have come simply to consult you as a preliminary step. I want a divorce, but the form in which it is possible is of great consequence to me. It's very possible that if that form does not correspond with my requirements, I may give up a legal divorce."
"Oh, that's always the case," said the lawyer. "And that's always for you to decide."
He let his eyes rest on Alexei Alexandrovitch's feet, feeling that he might offend his client by the sight of his irrepressible amusement. He looked at a moth that flew before his nose, and moved his hand, but didn't catch it out of regard for Alexei Alexandrovitch's position.
"Though in their general features our laws on this subject are known to me," pursued Alexei Alexandrovitch, "I should like to have an idea of the forms in which such things are done in practice." "You would like," the lawyer, without lifting his eyes, responded, adopting with a certain satisfaction the tone of his client's remarks, "for me to lay before you all the methods by which you could secure what you desire."
And on receiving an assenting nod from Alexei Alexandrovitch, he went on, stealing a glance now and then at Alexei Alexandrovitch's face, which was growing red in patches.
"Divorce by our laws," he said, with a slight shade of disapprobation of the laws, "is possible, as you are aware, in the following cases. Wait a minute," he called to a clerk who put his head in at the door.
But he got up all the same, said a few words to him, and sat down again.
"In the following cases, physical defect in the married parties, desertion without communication for 5 years," he said,
crooking a short finger covered with hair.
"Adultery."
This word he pronounced with obvious satisfaction.
"Subdivided as follows."
He continued to crook his fat fingers, though the three cases and their subdivisions could obviously not be classified together.
"Physical defect of the husband, or of the wife. Adultery of the husband, or of the wife."
Since by now all his fingers were used up, he uncrooked all of them and went on.
"This is the theoretical view. but I imagine you have done me the honour to apply to me in order to learn its application in practice, and therefore, guided by precedents, I must inform you that in practice, cases of divorce may all be reduced to the following. There's no physical defect, I may assume, nor desertion.
Alexei Alexandrovich bowed his head in assent.
May be reduced to the following. Adultery of one of the married parties, and the detection in the fact of the guilty party by mutual agreement, and failing such agreement, accidental detection. It must be admitted that the latter case is rarely met with in practice, said the lawyer,
and stealing a glance at Alexei Alexandrovich, he paused, as a man selling pistols after enlarging on the advantages of each weapon might await his customer's choice. But Alexei Alexandrovich said nothing, and therefore the lawyer went on.
The most usual and simple, the sensible course, I consider, is adultery by mutual consent. I should not permit myself to express it so, speaking with a man of no education, he said, but I imagine that to you this is comprehensible.
Alexei Alexandrovich was, however, so perturbed that he didn't immediately comprehend the reasonableness of adultery by mutual consent, and his eyes expressed this uncertainty. But the lawyer promptly came to his assistance.
People cannot go on living together. Here you have a fact. And if both are agreed about it, the details and formalities become a matter of no importance. And at the same time, this is the simplest and most certain method.
Alexei Alexandrovich fully understood now, but he had religious scruples which hindered the execution of such a plan.
That is out of the question in the present case, he said. Only one alternative is possible. Undesigned detection supported by letters, which I have.
At the mention of letters, the lawyer pursed his lips and gave utterance to a thin little compassionate and contemptuous sound.
Kindly consider, he began. Cases of that kind are, as you are aware, under ecclesiastical jurisdiction. The reverend fathers are fond of going into the minutest details in cases of that kind,
he said with a smile, which betrayed his sympathy with the reverend father's taste.
Letters may, of course, be a partial confirmation, but detection in the fact there must be of the most direct kind, that is, by eye-witness. In fact, if you do me the honour to entrust your confidence to me, you will do well to leave me the choice of the measures to be employed. If one wants the result, one must accept the means.
If it is so, Alexei Alexandrovich began, suddenly turning white. But at that moment the lawyer rose and again went to the door to speak to the intruding clerk.
Tell her we don't haggle over fees, he said,
and returned to Alexei Alexandrovich. On his way back he caught unobserved another moth.
Nice state my rep curtains will be in by the summer, he thought, frowning. And so you were saying, he said.
I'll communicate my decision to you by letter, said Alexei Alexandrovich, getting up, and he clutched at the table. After standing a moment in silence, he said,
From your words, I may consequently conclude that a divorce may be obtained.
I would ask you to let me know what are your terms.
It may be obtained if you give me complete liberty of action,
said the lawyer, not answering his question.
When can I count on receiving information from you? He asked,
moving toward the door, his eyes and his patent leather shoes shining.
In a week's time. Your answer as to whether you will undertake to conduct the case, and on what terms, you will be so good as to communicate to me. Very good.
The lawyer bowed respectfully, let his client out of the door, and left alone, gave himself up to his sense of amusement. He felt so mirthful that, contrary to his rules, he made a reduction in his terms to the haggling lady, and gave up catching moths, fully deciding that next winter he must have the furniture covered with velvet like Sigonin's. Chapter 6 Alexei Alexandrovich had gained a brilliant victory at the meeting of the Commission of the 17th of August, but the consequence of this victory cut the ground from under his feet. The new commission for the inquiry into the condition of the native population in all its branches had been formed and dispatched to its destination with an unusual speed and energy inspired by Alexei Alexandrovitch. Within 3 months, a report was presented. The condition of the natives was investigated in its political, administrative, economic, ethnographic, material, and religious aspects. To all these questions there were answers admirably stated, and answers admitting no shade of doubt, since they were not a product of human thought, always liable to error, but were all the product of official activity. The answers were all based on official data furnished by governors and heads of churches, and founded on the reports of district magistrates and ecclesiastical superintendents, founded in their turn on the reports of parochial overseers and parish priests, and so all of these answers were unhesitating and certain. All such questions as, for instance, of the cause of failure of crops, of the adherence of certain natives to their ancient beliefs, etc., questions which, but for the convenient intervention of the official machine, are not and cannot be solved for ages, received full, unhesitating solution. And this solution was in favour of Alexei Alexandrovitch's contention. But Stremov, who had felt stung to the quick at the last meeting, had, on the reception of the commission's report, resorted to tactics which Alexei Alexandrovitch had not anticipated. Stremov, bringing with him several other members, went over to Alexei Alexandrovitch's side, and not contenting himself with warmly defending the measures proposed by Karenin, proposed other, more extreme measures in the same direction. These measures, very much exaggerating Alexei Alexandrovitch's fundamental idea, were passed by the commission, and then the aim of Stremov's tactics became apparent. Carried to an extreme, the measures seemed at once to be so absurd that the highest authorities and public opinion and intellectual ladies and the newspapers all at the same time attacked them, expressing their indignation both with the measures and their nominal father, Alexei Alexandrovitch. Stremov drew back, affecting to have blindly followed Karenin, and to be astounded and distressed at what had been done. This meant the defeat of Alexei Alexandrovitch. But in spite of failing health, in spite of his domestic griefs, he did not give in. There was a split in the commission. Some members, with Stremov at their head, justified their mistake on the ground that they had put faith in the commission of revision instituted by Alexei Alexandrovitch, and maintained that the report of the commission was rubbish and simply so much waste paper. Alexei Alexandrovitch, with a following of those who saw the danger of so revolutionary an attitude to official documents, persisted in upholding the statements obtained by the revising commission. In consequence of this, in the highest spheres, and even in society, all was chaos. And although everyone was interested, no one could tell whether the natives really were becoming impoverished and ruined, or whether they were in a flourishing condition. The position of Alexei Alexandrovitch, due to this, and partly due to the contempt lavished on him for his wife's infidelity, became very precarious. And in this position, he took an important resolution. To the astonishment of the commission, he announced that he would ask permission to go himself to investigate the question on the spot. And having obtained permission, Alexei Alexandrovitch prepared to set off to these remote provinces. His departure created a great sensation, the more so because just before he started, he officially returned the travelling expense money allowed him for 12 horses, with which to drive to his destination.
"I think it very noble," Betsy said to the Princess Miakaya. "Why take money for post-horses when everyone knows that there are railways everywhere now?"
But Princess Miakaya didn't agree, and the Princess Tverskaya's opinion annoyed her.
"It's all very well for you to talk," said she, "when you have I don't know how many millions. But I'm very glad when my husband goes on an inspection tour in the summer. It's very good for him, and he enjoys travelling about. And we have an understanding by which I keep a carriage and coachman on that money."
On his way to the remote provinces, Alexei Alexandrovitch stopped for 3 days in Moscow. The day after his arrival, he was driving back from calling on the Governor-General. At the crossing by Gazetny Lane, where there are always crowds of carriages and sleighs, Alexei Alexandrovitch suddenly heard his name called in such a loud and cheerful voice that he couldn't help looking around. At the corner of the sidewalk, in a short, stylish overcoat, and a low-crowned fashionable hat jauntily askew, with a smile that showed a gleam of white teeth and red lips, stood Stepan Arkadyevitch, radiant, young, and beaming. He called him vigorously and urgently, and insisted on his stopping. He had one arm on the window of a carriage that was stopping at the corner, and out of the window were thrust the heads of a lady in a velvet hat and two children. Stepan Arkadyevitch was smiling and beckoning to his brother-in-law. The lady smiled a kindly smile too, and waved her hand to Alexei Alexandrovitch. It was Dolly with her children. Alexei Alexandrovitch didn't want to see anyone in Moscow, and least of all his wife's brother. He raised his hat and would have driven on, but Stepan Arkadyevitch told his coachman to stop and ran across the snow to him.
"Well, what a shame not to have let us know. Been here long?" "I was at Dussert's yesterday and saw Karenin on the visitors' list, but it never entered my head that it was you," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, sticking his head in at the window of the carriage. "Or I'd have looked you up. I am glad to see you," he said, knocking one foot against the other to shake off the snow. "What a shame not to let us know," he repeated.
"I had no time. I'm very busy," Alexei Alexandrovitch responded dryly.
"Come and say hello to my wife. She does so want to see you."
Alexei Alexandrovitch unfolded the comforter in which his frozen feet were wrapped, and getting out of his carriage, he made his way over the snow to Darya Alexandrovna.
"Why, Alexei Alexandrovitch, why are you avoiding us like this?" said Dolly, smiling.
"I was very busy. Delighted to see you," he said, in a tone clearly indicating that he was annoyed by it. "How are you?
Tell me, how's my darling Anna?"
Alexei Alexandrovitch mumbled something and was about to leave, but Stepan Arkadyevitch stopped him.
"I tell you what we'll do tomorrow. Dolly, ask him to dinner. We'll ask Koznishev and Pestsov so as to treat him to our Moscow intelligentsia."
"Yes, please do come," said Dolly. "We'll expect you at 5 or 6 o'clock, if you like. How is my darling Anna? How long?"
"She's quite well," Alexei Alexandrovitch mumbled, frowning. "Delighted."
And he moved away toward his carriage.
"You will come?"
Dolly called after him. Alexei Alexandrovitch said something that Dolly couldn't catch in the noise of the moving carriages.
"I'll come over tomorrow,"
Stepan Arkadyevitch shouted to him. Alexei Alexandrovitch got into his carriage and buried himself in it so as neither to see nor to be seen.
"Strange fish," said Stepan Arkadyevitch to his wife.
And glancing at his watch, he made a motion of his hand before his face, indicating a caress to his wife and children, and walked jauntily along the pavement.
"Stiva! Stiva!"
Dolly called, reddening. He turned around.
"I must get coats, you know, for Grisha and Tanya. Give me the money."
"Never mind. You tell them I'll pay the bill."
And he vanished, nodding genially to an acquaintance who drove by. Chapter 7 The next day was Sunday. Stepan Arkadyevitch went to the Bolshoi Theatre to a rehearsal of the ballet and gave Masha Chibisova, a pretty dancer whom he had just taken under his patronage, the coral necklace he had promised her the evening before, and behind the scenery in the dim daylight of the theatre he managed to kiss her pretty little face, radiant over her present. Besides the gift of the necklace, he wanted to arrange their meeting after the ballet. After explaining that he couldn't come at the beginning of the ballet, he promised he would come for the last act and take her to supper. From the theatre, Stepan Arkadyevitch drove to a Hockney Row, the market, selected himself the fish and the asparagus for dinner, and by 12 o'clock was at Dussert's, where he had to see 3 people, luckily all staying at the same hotel. Levin, who had recently come back from abroad and was staying there, the new head of his department, who had just been promoted to that position and had come on an inspection tour to Moscow, and his brother-in-law, Karenin, whom he must see, so as to be sure of bringing him to dinner. Stepan Arkadyevitch liked dining, but still better, he liked to give a dinner, small but very choice, both as regards the food and drink and as regards the selection of guests. He particularly liked the menu of that day's dinner. There would be fresh perch, asparagus, and la pièce de résistance, first-rate but quite plain, roast beef, and the appropriate wines. So much for the eating and drinking. Kitty and Levin would be guests, and so that this might not be too obvious, there would be a girl cousin too, and young Shishchabatsky, and la pièce de résistance among the guests, Sergei Kozhnyshev and Alexei Alexandrovich Karenin. Sergei Ivanovich was a Moscow man and a philosopher, Alexei Alexandrovich a Petersburger and a practical politician. He was asking, too, the well-known eccentric enthusiast Pestsov, a liberal, a great talker, a musician, a historian, and the most delightfully youthful person of 50 who would be sauce and garnish for Kozhnyshev and Karenin. He would provoke them and set them off. The second installment of the forest money had been received from the merchant and was not yet exhausted. Dolly had been very amiable and good-humoured of late, and the idea of the dinner pleased Stepan Arkadyevich from every point of view. He was in the most light-hearted mood. There were two circumstances a little unpleasant, but these two circumstances were drowned in the sea of good-humoured gaiety which flooded the soul of Stepan Arkadyevich. These two circumstances were, first, that on meeting Alexei Alexandrovich the day before in the street, he had noticed that he was cold and reserved with him, and putting together the expression of Alexei Alexandrovich's face, and the fact that he had not come to see them or let them know of his arrival with the rumours he had heard about Anna and Vronsky, Stepan Arkadyevich guessed that something was wrong between husband and wife. That was one disagreeable thing. The other slightly disagreeable fact was that the new head of his department, like all new heads, had the reputation already of a terrible person, who got up at 6 o'clock in the morning, worked like a horse, and insisted on his subordinates working in the same way. Moreover, this new head had the further reputation of being a bear in his manners, and was, according to all rumours, a man of a class in all respects the opposite of that to which his predecessor had belonged, and to which Stepan Arkadyevich had hitherto belonged himself. On the previous day, Stepan Arkadyevich had appeared at the office in uniform, and the new chief had been very affable, and had talked to him as to an acquaintance. Consequently, Stepan Arkadyevich deemed it his duty to call upon him in his frock coat. The thought that the new chief might not give him a warm reception was the other unpleasant thing, but Stepan Arkadyevich instinctively felt that everything would work out all right. "They're all people, all men, like us poor sinners. Why be nasty and quarrelsome?" he thought, as he went into the hotel. "Good day, Vasily," he said, walking into the corridor with his hat cocked to one side and addressing a footman he knew. "Why, you've let your whiskers grow. Levin, number 7, eh? Take me up, please. And find out whether Count Anichkin," this was the new head, "is receiving." "Yes, sir," Vasily responded, smiling. "You've not been to see us for a long while." "I was here yesterday, but at the other entrance. Is this number 7? Levin was standing with a peasant from Tver in the middle of the room, measuring a fresh bearskin when Stepan Arkadyevich went in.
"What? You killed him?" cried Stepan Arkadyevich. "Well done! A she-bear! How are you, Achip?"
He shook hands with the peasant and sat down on the edge of a chair without taking off his coat and hat.
"Come, take off your coat and stay a little," said Levin, taking his hat. "No, I haven't time. I've only looked in for a second," answered Stepan Arkadyevich.
He threw open his coat, but afterwards did take it off, and stayed for a whole hour, talking to Levin about hunting and the most intimate subjects.
"Come, tell me, please, what you did abroad." "Where have you been?" said Stepan Arkadyevich, when the peasant had gone. "Oh, I stayed in Germany, in Prussia, in France and in England, not in the capitals, but in the manufacturing towns, and saw a great deal that was new to me, and I'm glad I went."
"Yes, I knew your idea of the solution of the labour question."
"Not at all."
"In Russia there can be no labour question. In Russia the question is that of the relation of the working people to the land, though the question exists there too. But there it's a matter of repairing what's been ruined, while with us—"
Stepan Arkadyevich listened attentively to Levin.
"Yes, yes," he said. "It's very possible you're right.
but I'm glad you're in good spirits and are hunting bears and working and interested. Shchebatsky told me another story. He met you. That you were in such a depressed state, talking of nothing but death.
Well, what of it?
I've not given up thinking of death, said Levin.
It's true that it's high time I was dead, and that all this is nonsense.
It's the truth I'm telling you.
I do value my idea and my work very highly, but in reality only consider this. All this world of ours is nothing but a speck of mildew which has grown up on a tiny planet. And for us to suppose we can have something great, ideas, work, it's all grains of sand.
But all that's as old as the hills, my boy.
It is old. But do you know, when you grasp this fully, then somehow everything becomes of no consequence. When you understand that you will die tomorrow, if not today, and nothing will be left, then everything is so unimportant. And I consider my ideas very important, but they turn out to be as unimportant, even if they were carried out, as walking around this bearskin. So one goes on living, amusing oneself with hunting, with work, anything, so as not to think of death.
Stepan Arkadyevitch smiled a subtle and affectionate smile as he listened to Levin.
Well, of course. Here, you've come round to my point. Do you remember you attacked me for seeking enjoyment in life? Don't be so severe, O moralist.
No. All the same, what's fine in life is...
Levin hesitated.
Oh, I don't know. All I know is that we shall soon be dead.
Why so soon?
And do you know, there's less charm in life when one thinks of death, but there's more peace.
On the contrary, the finish is always the best. But I must be going, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, getting up for the 10th time.
Oh, no, stay a while, said Levin, detaining him.
Now, when shall we see each other again?
I'm going tomorrow.
I'm a prize package. Why, that's just what I came for. You simply must come to dinner with us today. Your brother's coming, and Karenin, my brother-in-law.
You don't mean to say he's here, said Levin,
and he wanted to inquire about Kitty. He had heard at the beginning of the winter that she was in Petersburg with her sister, the wife of the diplomat, and he didn't know whether she had come back or not. But he changed his mind and didn't ask.
Whether she's coming or not, I don't care, he said to himself.
So you'll come.
Of course.
At 5 o'clock, then, and not in evening dress.
And Stepan Arkadyevitch got up and went down below to the new head of his department. Instinct had not misled Stepan Arkadyevitch. The terrible new head turned out to be an extremely amiable person, and Stepan Arkadyevitch lunched with him and stayed on, so that it was 4 o'clock before he got to Alexei Alexandrovitch. Chapter 8 Alexei Alexandrovitch, on coming back from church service, had spent the whole morning indoors. He had two pieces of business before him that morning. First, to receive and send on a deputation from the native population which was on its way to Petersburg and now at Moscow. Second, to write the promised letter to the lawyer. The deputation, though it had been summoned at Alexei Alexandrovitch's instigation, was not without its discomforting and even dangerous aspect, and he was glad he had found it in Moscow. The members of this deputation had not the slightest conception of their duty and the part they were to play. They naively believed that it was their business to lay before the commission their needs and the actual condition of things, and to ask assistance of the government, and utterly failed to grasp that some of their statements and requests supported the contention of the enemy's side, and so spoiled the whole business. Alexei Alexandrovitch was busily engaged with them for a long while, drew up a programme for them from which they were not to deviate, and, on dismissing them, wrote a letter to Petersburg for the guidance of the deputation. He had his chief support in this affair in the Countess Lydia Ivanovna. She was a specialist in the matter of deputations, and no one knew better than she how to manage them and guide them in the proper direction. Having completed this task, Alexei Alexandrovitch wrote the letter to the lawyer. Without the slightest hesitation, he gave him permission to act as he thought best. In the letter,
He enclosed 3 of Vronsky's notes to Anna, which were in the portfolio he had taken away. Since Alexei Alexandrovitch had left home with the intention of not returning to his family again, and since he had been at the lawyer's and had spoken, though only to one man, of his intention, and especially since he had translated the matter from the world of real life to the world of ink and paper, he had grown more and more used to his own intention, and by now distinctly perceived the feasibility of its execution. He was sealing the envelope to the lawyer when he heard the loud tones of Stepan Arkadyevitch's voice.
Stepan Arkadyevitch was arguing with Alexei Alexandrovitch's servant and insisting on being announced. "No matter," thought Alexei Alexandrovitch. "So much the better. I will inform him at once of my position in regard to his sister, and explain why it is I can't dine with him." "Come in," he said loudly, collecting his papers and putting them in the folder.
"There, you see, you're talking nonsense, and he's at home," responded Stepan Arkadyevitch's voice, addressing the servant, who had refused to let him in, and taking off his coat as he went, Oblonsky walked into the room. "Well, I'm awfully glad I found you, so I hope—" Stepan Arkadyevitch began cheerfully. "I cannot come," Alexei Alexandrovitch said coldly, standing and not asking his visitor to sit down.
Alexei Alexandrovitch had expected to enter at once into those cold relations in which he ought to be with the brother of a wife against whom he was beginning a suit for divorce. But he had not taken into account the ocean of kindliness brimming over in the heart of Stepan Arkadyevitch. Stepan Arkadyevitch opened wide his clear, shining eyes.
"Why can't you? What do you mean?" he asked in perplexity, speaking in French. "Oh, but it's a promise, and we're all counting on you."
"I want to tell you I can't dine at your house because the family relationship which has existed between us must cease."
"How? How do you mean? What for?"
said Stepan Arkadyevitch with a smile.
"Because I'm beginning an action for divorce against your sister, my wife. I ought to have—"
But before Alexei Alexandrovitch had time to finish his sentence, Stepan Arkadyevitch behaved not at all as he had expected. He groaned and sank into an armchair.
"No, Alexei Alexandrovitch, what are you saying?" cried Oblonsky,
and his suffering was apparent in his face.
"It is so. Excuse me, I can't believe it."
Alexei Alexandrovitch sat down, feeling that his words had not had the effect he anticipated, and that it would be unavoidable for him to explain his position, and that, whatever explanations he might make, his relations with his brother-in-law would remain unchanged.
"Yes, I am brought to the painful necessity of seeking a divorce," he said. "I will say one thing, Alexei Alexandrovitch. I know you for an excellent, upright man. I know Anna. Excuse me, I can't change my opinion of her. For a good and excellent woman, and so, excuse me, I can't believe it. There's some misunderstanding," said he.
"Oh, if it were merely a misunderstanding—"
"Wait, I understand," interposed Stepan Arkadyevitch. "But of course, one thing,
you mustn't act in haste. You must not. You must not act in haste." "I'm not acting in haste," Alexei Alexandrovitch said coldly. "But one cannot ask advice of anyone in such a matter. I have made up my mind."
"This is awful," said Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"I would do one thing, Alexei Alexandrovitch." "I beseech you, do it," he said. "No action has yet been taken, if I understand rightly. Before you take advice, see my wife, talk to her. She loves Anna like a sister. She loves you. And she's a wonderful woman. For God's sake, talk to her. Do me that favour, I beseech you."
Alexei Alexandrovitch pondered, and Stepan Arkadyevitch looked at him sympathetically, without interrupting his silence.
"You will go to see her?" "I don't know. That was just why I've not been to see you. I imagine our relations must change."
"Why so?"
"I don't see that. Allow me to believe that apart from our family connection, you have for me, at least in part, the same friendly feeling I've always had for you.
and sincere esteem, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, pressing his hand.
Even if your worst suppositions were correct, I don't, and never would, take on myself to judge either side, and I see no reason why our relations should be affected. But now do this, and come and see my wife.
Well, we look at the matter differently, said Alexei Alexandrovitch coldly. However, we won't discuss it.
No. Why shouldn't you come today to dine anyway? My wife's expecting you. Please do come. And above all, talk it over with her. She's a wonderful woman. For God's sake, on my knees, I implore you.
If you wish it so much, I will come, said Alexei Alexandrovitch, sighing.
And anxious to change the conversation, he inquired about what interested them both, the new head of Stepan Arkadyevitch's department, a man not yet old who had suddenly been promoted to so high a position. Alexei Alexandrovitch had previously felt no liking for Count Anichkin and had always differed from him in his opinions. But now, from a feeling readily comprehensible to officials, that hatred felt by one who has suffered a defeat in the service for one who has received a promotion, he could not endure him.
"Well, have you seen him?" said Alexei Alexandrovitch with a malignant smile.
"Of course. He was at our meeting yesterday. He seems to know his work perfectly and to be very energetic."
"Yes, but what is his energy directed to?" said Alexei Alexandrovitch. "Is he aiming at doing anything, or simply undoing what's been done? It's the great misfortune of our government, this red-tape administration, of which he's a worthy representative."
"Really, I don't know what fault one could find with him. His policy? I don't know. But one thing, he's a very nice fellow," answered Stepan Arkadyevitch. "I've just been seeing him, and he's really a nice fellow. We lunched together, and I taught him how to make, you know that drink, wine and oranges. It's so cooling. And it's a wonder he didn't know it. He liked it very much. No, really, he's a nice fellow."
Stepan Arkadyevitch glanced at his watch.
"Why, good heavens, it's after 4 already, and I've still got to go to Dolgovushin's. So please come to dinner. You can't imagine how you will grieve my wife and me if you don't."
The way in which Alexei Alexandrovitch saw his brother-in-law out was very different from the manner in which he had met him.
"I've promised, and I'll come," he answered wearily.
"Believe me, I appreciate it, and I hope you won't regret it," answered Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling.
And putting on his coat as he went, he patted the footman on the head, chuckled, and went out.
"At 5 o'clock! And not in evening dress, please," he shouted once more, turning at the door.